from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasnia. We are live from Castlemont High School in East Oakland. In this forum hour, we continue with our focus on the high school dropout crisis and the search for solutions with policymakers and education reformers who have given the issue a great deal of thought. We'll ask them, is the problem only about schools, or does it have more systemic causes? And what are some of the proven innovative approaches to help alleviate the problem? Forum is next. Join us and feel free to join in when we open our phones. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and we are live in East Oakland at Castlemont High School. And what we're doing today here is talking about the ongoing concern, dropout problem, dropout crisis, call it what you will, but it is certainly something that we all face. And in this hour, we want to continue our focus on the high school dropout crisis, but talk about search for solutions with policymakers and education reformers. I should tell you some statistics. There are some 1 million youngsters who drop out of high school each year in the United States. That's about 7,000 a day. And the numbers in these budgetary lean times appear to be on the rise. What we want to talk about in this hour is what can be done. And we're, as I say, talking with some well-known policymakers and reformers about that. Michael Kirst is president of the California State Board of Education and professor emeritus of education at Stanford University. Mike Kirst, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Professor Russell Rumberger is here with us as well. He's Vice Provost for Education Partnerships, works out of the UC Office of the President, also directs the California Dropout Research Project, and is author of the book Dropping Out. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Fania Davis, who is Executive Director of the Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, and welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
We also want to welcome Tony Smith, PhD, who is Superintendent of Oakland Joint Unified School District. Welcome, Tony Smith.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And Tony Smith, I'm going to begin with you. We were talking a little bit about full-service community schools, and I want to get to that. But first of all, let me get to a basic question here. We have roughly 18.2% dropout rate nationally. It's 25%, 18.2% in the state. Here in Oakland, it's 40%. I mean, I know it's a complicated question, but why so much higher?
Well, I think first, the frame of dropout, I just want to name again that the really holding responsibility as adults and thinking about them as pushing kids out of the system. And when you look at one kid every 26 seconds or 7,000 a day, 1.2 million a year, I think we really are talking about a structural issue, about our inability to serve the young people who are in our country now. So structurally, I think we're failing children, and I think that's a result of many decisions over many years. I think the issue in the urban core, you heard young people talking about the extreme distress, the trauma, the need, and the way in which the city hasn't held and cared for the whole family and the whole child. So I think the issue in the urban core really is that there are histories, structuralized, racialized practices that have whole groups of families out of the sphere of success. And so we have to figure out in schools how to hold on to more children and families and create the connections. And we've really attempted to do that through a community schools approach.
Talk about that. I mean, how does that work? It's trying to connect the dots, community schools, the institutions, basically.
Sure. The idea of a community school really is to create the support structures for children that any middle or upper middle class family has, that the well-being of the child is at the center, and we talk about finding ways to support the young person, whether it's with food, whether it's with counseling services, whether it's just a place to feel safe and connected. I mean, many of the things, and this is a really extraordinary panel, folks on the panel know deeply and historically what it takes to hold kids. We are trying to create those conditions in some of the most high-need neighborhoods. And it's really, a full-service community school is really a school that just knows its young people well and provides us resources necessary for them to be successful and has high-quality academic content.
Well, we heard a lot in the last hour about love, but there's lack of resources now. I mean, the money continues to be, although you had a $40 million deficit here that sort of doesn't exist anymore, really. That's good news.
Well, it's really hard work, and we've had to make hard decisions, and the school board's taken a real strong stand that we have to be socially progressive and provide the kind of quality services for children that they deserve. We have to have a really clear fiscal balance, and to get to academic solvency, we've gotten now to fiscal solvency and eliminated a $40 million structural deficit, so the expenditures were $40 million greater than revenue when we got the district.
Bravo.
Fania
Davis is still applauding. I'll applaud that, too. Yeah. You've got a 7-year plan to decrease or diminish the number of dropouts. What are you envisioning there? What's going to be moving ahead on that 7-year plan?
Well, I think the piece about the diminishing the dropouts is really staying focused on what our young people need and looking at workforce development and the health and well-being of the city. With so many 18 to 24 year olds out of work, particularly African American Latino young men, we've said that we need to be preparing young people for success in the world of work, college, continual learning. We're talking about redesigning much more linked learning and making high schools a place of preparation for civic engagement and healthy participation. So the rethinking of high school connected to workforce and economic development is a major shift. And I think supporting our elementary schools and middle school kids to be academically proficient, to have community service, but then to really make a deeper connection in the high school to the world of work and service, I think we're going to see a big change. And, you know, I would just offer again that so much of this conversation is framed around the failure of a school system. And when we talk about 1.2 million kids a year not finishing high school, I think we have to really look at it as our failure as a country to serve and meet the needs of our children. And until we think structurally about that and how it plays out differentially by race and class and language status, I think we're missing the larger conversation. But schools definitely have to transform and be part of that solution.
Tony Smith, PhD superintendent of the Oakland Joint Unified School District. Michael Kirst, again, is president of California State Board of Education and professor emeritus of education at Stanford University, has long been involved in the struggle to bring better education to the state of California. It's getting better from your perspective, Michael?
Well, it's getting better in some ways, and it's getting more difficult in others. It's getting better in the sense that we're much more working intensively on new and better curriculum, on new and better assessment. We're much more intervening early in problems, and such as chronic absence where students don't come to school. We have a better handle, I think, on the dropout problem in the sense that it's really a preschool through the senior year issue. It's sort of like feeling an elephant. If students who come to school with very little vocabulary, who can't read by third grade, you know, that's a trajectory for dropout there. The middle school is another area. So we're getting more aware of how to do this. But the worst part is the funding. I mean, we have, in the whole United States, the fewest adults in schools that are in touch with children or work with children of any state in the country. So we're 50th in counselors, librarians, school psychologists, and we're near the bottom in class size. So much of the conversation in the first hour was about personalization, about students and teachers and community members interacting. We just don't have many personnel out there. And to me, the top priority right now is revenue to sustain this. So I think that's the crucial issue that we face at this point, is understanding the manifold and interconnected nature of the dropout problem. And then we need more funding and more people to help children in the system. And lastly, I agree with Oakland's approach of it's got to be the whole community. These kids face chronic stress, as you said in the first hour. That's not a problem the teacher in the classroom can entirely deal with.
Well, that brings up a question that actually I've been meaning to ask you. I'm glad we have you on here today because it's gone round and round on forum, and you have been on forum so many times talking about your concern with education. We had Diane Ravitch on, formerly with the Bush administration, who talks about the main problem being poverty. And we have Michelle Rion, who talks about the main problem being teachers and getting teachers motivated and putting the emphasis on test scores and all of that. Can you talk about where the emphasis ought to be? Or I mean, that's an ongoing perennial debate, I realize, but you have to kind of have a triage system, don't you?
Yes, I agree with what's sort of called a bigger, bolder approach, which is it's poverty and it's teaching, and it's more things than that. And so I think this is a polarized argument that's not getting us anywhere, and the two interact. I think the first hour, it was very clear that the students are facing problems in the communities, in their peer groups, in terms of dropping out is okay if and makes you friends, and sometimes in your peer group. So it's much deeper than any of those, and it's an interconnected problem. That's why I think we're so having such a difficult time dealing with it.
Can you talk also a little bit, Mike, about graduation rates? There are new cohorts based on mobility. There's CalPADS. I'd just like people to be informed about what's going on, because the numbers are kind of, to use Polly Stryker's word, squishy here as far as dropout numbers statewide.
Well, we're finally getting them much better, and I think we've straightened out the system. We now have in the state an ability to follow children. They have an identification number, and as they move around the state, we can tell whether they're reentering somewhere in the state. So our numbers are getting much better, but students who move back to Mexico, for example, or out of state, we still have trouble. Russ Rumberger is the national expert on these numbers, and I would defer to him to my left.
Well, let's defer to Russ Rumberger, and then we'll talk to Fania Davis about restorative justice, which we talked about a bit in the last hour. We're getting a better hold on numbers, Russ.
Yeah, the longitudinal data system that Mike talked about really does allow us to track students. And as he said, it's not perfect because you can't track them out of the state. You can track them in the state pretty well. But for the first time last summer, the state was able to identify what's called a four-year graduation rate. It's the kids that entered school 4 years earlier as ninth grade, how many of them earned a diploma in 4 years. And this year they'll come out, I think, with a five-year graduation rate, because some students actually take longer than 4 years to graduate, so we'll be able to know, maybe up the number a little bit. It was about 74.4% for the first estimate last year, and some of those from that cohort may eventually earn a diploma in their fifth year of school, so that might bump up our grad rate numbers, but they're definitely better than they used to be.
Push-out rates are lower too, aren't they, generally?
Push-out rates being dropout rates?
Push-out rates in terms of their connection to dropout rates are being down, no?
Well, we don't have longitudinal figures on the dropout rates. See, last year was the first year we had this figure. So what we know is how many kids drop out each year, you know, starting in seventh grade. But what we really want to know is, we want to know that, but we also want to know a cohort, that is the students that enter as ninth graders, how many of them either finish, drop out, maybe drop out and re-enter. Ideally, in our system, we'd know whether they went into adult school maybe and earned a diploma later on. So we don't really have a great handle on the kind of ultimate outcomes of a lot of these kids who may earn alternative diplomas or even regular diplomas through alternative means, so adult school being probably the biggest one. But there's a lot of other programs. So we probably underestimate, actually, the number of students that earn some kind of secondary credential in our state. And We don't have a way to totally do that, even with our new system, but we're better.
I think you see some of these trends as, well, frankly, depressing. Why?
Well, the depressing trend is that our graduation rates in the United States are no higher and actually a little bit lower than they were 40 years ago. So that's depressing. The more optimistic view is that it kind of bottomed around 1995, and it's been slowly going up, you know, since 1995, and over the last, you know, 9 or 10 years, there's been a marked improvement in the rates nationally, and I think in California as well. So the long-term trend is sobering, but the short-term trend is a little more optimistic. You know, I think all this attention the problem is getting nationally, state, locally, these efforts are, I think, yielding some results. There's a huge commitment on the part of a lot of organizations nationally. The Alliance is one of the Alliance for Excellent Education, America's Promise, United Way. There's just a lot of organizations that are really committed to it. So I think all that is bearing some fruit. I just think the problem is very complex, as Tony and Mike have pointed out. So we're making some progress. There's just a lot more to go.
Well, what about progress in terms of solutions? I mean, that's what we want to focus on this hour. You've been trying to improve the pipeline of higher education. Is that a big part of it?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, there's the call by the President of the United States to raise the college graduation rate in the United States to being number one in the world. And in order to do that, we've got to really increase our high school graduation rate as well as our success rate in colleges. So the pipeline is all connected, you know, as Mike suggested, from early childhood on. But at the high school level, we're talking about getting more kids in and out of high school. We're getting more kids in and out of college, and it's all interconnected. So it's a huge challenge.
Russell Rumberger, again, is Vice Provost for Education Partnerships with the UC Office of the President, and he also directs the California Dropout Research Project and is author of the book Dropping Out. Fania Davis is Executive Director of Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. And talk about pipelines, Fania Davis. This may shock some listeners, but students who drop out, 70% become incarcerated, 75% of California's inmates are high school dropouts, and those are pretty shocking numbers.
Yes.
So what to do? What to do about this pipeline?
Yes, keeping children in school is the strongest protective factor against violence and incarceration. So that means really trying to find alternatives to suspending, to out-of-school suspensions, alternatives to expulsions, alternatives to school-based arrests, all of which have been soaring in the last decade, very much parallel to what's been happening with our prison system, with the soaring of incarceration rates to the extent that we incarcerate more people than any nation has in the history of humanity. We see something parallel happening in school discipline systems.
Well, this is where restorative justice comes in, and you, of course, are one of the best-known in the state spokespeople for restorative justice. What about restorative justice in terms of its viability as opposed to, say, zero tolerance? Because we certainly heard a lot about zero tolerance. Yeah.
Well, in terms of its viability, yeah, I think it has far more viability, well, needless to say. A lot of people say about restorative justice, well, you're coddling the criminals, you're soft on crime, you're not really holding them accountable. But my response to that is that I think that these zero-tolerance policies, tough-on-crime policies, are actually really soft on crime, because they grow crime. Because when people are arrested, when youth are arrested, when youth are incarcerated or even expelled or suspended, their chances of reoffending really skyrocket from having that experience of being in the streets and not doing their work, from having that experience of being incarcerated.
They Can you give come us an back. Example of how it works, how restorative justice works, just so we know what we're talking about here?
Well, let's say Tommy is seen in the hallway cursing his teacher, you know, yelling at the top of his lungs. The teacher is in tow. Principal hears, school security office officer hears. They come and are ready to suspend right away. Enter our restorative justice coordinator. Principal, can't we try a restorative alternative here? And with some persuasion, the principal will relent. And so we do a circle. We go and track down the mom. In the circle, we have the mom, the principal, the teacher, and the young man, Tommy, the person harmed, the person responsible for the harm, and a trained facilitator and the principal. We get to hear Tommy's story. Well, why did you do what you did? What were you thinking at the time when you yelled at your teacher? He had his head down on the desk. The teacher asked him to sit up straight twice. He yells back at her and just goes off. Right. So we find in this circle when we sit and talk to Tommy that for the last 4 days he has been going home to an empty house. His mom was on drugs. She had been in a substance use treatment program but had relapsed. He'd been going back, no food. Maybe a couple of cans of beans that were empty after a couple of days. Sleepy, tired, not able to sleep at home, scared. So when he had his head down on the desk in the classroom, it's because he was tired, because he was worried. So we learned this. We wouldn't have learned it if we just kicked him out summarily. We also learn he gets to hear the teacher say, well, you know, I was assaulted and hurt very badly. I had to be hospitalized last year because of a youth who was yelling at me like you are now. And it hurt me so much, it affected me so badly, I thought I would quit. So he gets to hear this. And then they both get to decide, well, what can Tommy do to repair the harm? He apologizes and he agrees that he'll help her with after-school chores for the rest of the year. The mom is reconnected to some substance abuse treatment counselors who are right there at the school campus. The teacher ends up staying. She's happy. Tommy actually stays in school and does much better. So that's just sort of a case study of how it could work.
Yeah, no, that was very well rendered. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And overall, do we have numbers? Do we have statistics in terms of kids staying in school? And particularly, I'd like to get a breakdown from you about restorative justice and how necessary it is, particularly with kids of color and kids who are English learners.
Oh, totally. We do have numbers. We have numbers in Oakland and numbers in throughout the U.S. Let's start with Oakland. We started our program, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, in 2007 at Cole Middle School. That was a pilot that was studied by UC Berkeley Law, and the researchers found that there was an 87% reduction in suspension rate. Complete elimination of violence, elimination of the teacher attrition problem, because teachers are constantly cycling in and out because schools can sometimes be very difficult places to work. That's one. And then just today, Tony and I were talking about an email that we got from another school that's a pilot site, United for Success. They, in 2 years, have reduced suspension rates to 50%. And on the racial disproportionality issue, they have eliminated racial disparities for African Americans and for Latinos.
I think I'm right in these statistics. Suspension and expulsion in California rates close to 10%, whereas nationally it's just 7%. So we're higher in this state right now than we are probably anywhere else in the country.
Yes, but all suspension rates across the board in the country are much higher than they were just 10 years ago. And then there are other statistics, too. Here at Castlemont, we have a program that's sponsored by the California Endowment, which is doing similar programs in schools throughout the state. We are just really getting started in our first year. Sagnite, who was on the panel earlier, is one of our coordinators, one of three coordinators that we have. And we're seeing some early results that are very, very encouraging here, too, in terms of eliminating disparity and reducing suspension rates by close to 50% already in just the first semester, really, of full operation of the program.
I haven't even given out the number yet, but we have a caller, David, who wants to address what we're talking about. David, please join us. You're on forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm a psychologist. I've spent many years working with at-risk youth in correctional institutions, and majority of the kids who we work with are dropouts. And what I've seen in my work is that we need to look at kids who have particular intelligences, learning styles. And I find that the majority of the kids have a kinesthetic ability. They need to use their bodies to express their intelligences. And I think maybe going with technical high schools, and you could still feed the arts, the academics, into those schools, rather than trying to put everyone in the same mold, so to speak. Again, all my work in juvenile hall, these kids, when you give them an opportunity to use their kinesthetic abilities, they succeed. It's like creating a success identity. And that is the direction we've gone, and it's been fairly successful.
Well, it's a hopeful note, and we're glad to hear it, and we thank you for that. In fact, we'd like to hear from the rest of you. Let me give out the phone number, because we do invite your phone calls, and you're cordially invited to participate in this discussion we're having about solutions to the dropout problem. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And the kids in the audience, the young people here from Castlemont, experiences with discipline at school and what happened, again, what keeps you in school, and, well, you know about life outside for some of those who have dropped out. But also, we're talking about restorative justice. If you've been through that, you may want to bring your own voice into the discussion as well. You're cordially invited to participate, too. We're talking with Fania Davis, who is Executive Director of Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, with Tony Smith, the Superintendent of Oakland Joint Unified Schools, Michael Kirst, Professor of California State Board of Education, and President of California State Board of Education, and Professor Russell Rumberger from the Provost's Office. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and in a special live broadcast this morning, we are at Oakland's Castlemont High School, East Oakland Castlemont High, with a live studio audience. And we're continuing to talk about the dropout crisis in public schools, talking with policymakers and education reformers who have given this issue a great deal of thought, and asking, is the problem only about the schools, or does it have more systemic causes? And what are some of the proven and innovative approaches to help alleviate the problem? Discussing this hour with Professor Russell Rumberger, who is Vice Provost for Education Partnerships, author of Dropping Out, and he's with the University of California Office of the President. He also directs the California Dropout Research Project. And Michael Kirst, President of the California State Board of Education, Professor Emeritus of Education at Stanford. Fania Davis, who is Executive Director of the Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. And Tony Smith, Superintendent of the Oakland Joint Unified School District. And Superintendent Smith, you had something you wanted to add here.
I did. Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on something, a point Fania made. And I think underneath restorative justice, sometimes people think it's just an opportunity for kids to get out of the discipline process. I believe it's actually a skills development process. It's actually a capacity building process. And in terms of building the protective agency or the capacity for young people to solve and resolve problems, to increase health and well-being in our community, to really develop the sensibility that we belong to each other as citizens in Oakland, and when there are moments like that, as she so eloquently described, that's a rupture in a relationship. And if we don't, in fact, rebuild and learn how to be in right relationship after something like that, that pattern plays out over and over and over again. I would argue that many of the zero tolerance policies that you named and a lot of people stand by actually cultivate the conditions for antisocial behavior. And restorative justice, I believe, is a pro-social structure for increasing our capacity to both stay in school, to develop a sense of belonging, and learn how, quite frankly, to resolve conflict. And I don't think we've done a very good job of that. And if we can build a system that does that, I think we'll see a transformation not only inside the school, but actually in and around community.
Fania Davis, want to add here?
Oh, totally. One of the things I wanted to add, actually, is that this community building and this sort of reaffirming of our inherent interrelatedness with one another as human beings is really at the core, philosophically, of restorative justice. And restorative justice is really a historic shift in the way that we respond to wrongdoing, from punitive ways that replicate harm to more restorative ways that heal it. So we're really talking about completely flipping the script. I know we sometimes think that our criminal justice system, which responds to harm with more harm, in fact, I always say ours is a system that harms people who harm people, to show that harming people is wrong. So harm is replicated. And as Sagnite said earlier, harmed people go on to harm people. So that's why I say the punitive system, the zero tolerance system, actually is soft on crime. It's worse than soft on crime. It grows it. It replicates it. It reproduces it.
Let me say, you kind of intimated that there's a historical background for restorative justice. It goes, well, it was used in South Africa, obviously, but in Mennonite communities, indigenous groups used it. It certainly has a track record, and a pretty impressive track record. I think it started in Ontario, in fact, at least in this part of the world, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah. Yes.
What about this in the grand picture? How do you see it, Michael Kirst?
Well, I think, again, to go back to the theme, that this is part of a large picture of many things. Right here in this school, we have an example of the biggest bet ever made on how to solve dropout problems. Bill Gates spent $2 billion forming small schools. It was the initial initiative of his foundation. And after 3 or 4 years of looking at it and not getting results that he wanted on dropouts or going to college or test scores, he pulled the plug on the whole thing. And so his view was that you could do a single sort of variable, change the organization, make the schools small and personalize them, and that will stop dropouts. Well, that's part of the picture, but he also left a legacy from what we heard in the first one of the fact that these schools are expensive and very hard to maintain, these many small schools. So you have to do several things at once, and you have to put them together in an integrated way, and then you have to have adequate financing to carry these things on. They can't be stopping and starting and moving from this is a solution to that. It's a very complex interwoven thing, and it starts much much earlier than high school.
Maybe preschool?
Yeah.
Let me go back to Professor Rumberger here, and then we'll go to your calls and we'll go to our audience and so forth, because you say something that really is quite striking about changing the whole notion of high school achievement and what high school achievement means, so that a high school diploma shouldn't just qualify you for more school. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we've defined high school success very narrowly, and there's been such a push to get kids ready for college and thinking college is the only place for everybody to go. And so we focus on academics alone, and the academics are college-bound academics, so there's not academics necessarily for students who don't want to go to college, maybe go to community college. We don't have enough of career and technical education. You know, as Tony pointed out, the link learning movement is trying to generate that idea. But I would go even beyond all of that. And that is, I think we need to really recognize a broader, or redefine what I call redefine high school success, to include things that are not measured by tests and academic achievement. So what economists call it non-cognitive skills. Some people call it 21st century skills. Some people call it deeper learning. There's different terms that are used. But the idea is that there's a whole bunch of skills and abilities that both would-be students, future students, and future workers need to be successful. And some of those are academic skills, but some of them are interpersonal skills, their ability to work together, their things like punctuality and perseverance.
Interpersonal skills can come from restorative justice?
They could. Yeah. They could be. But we don't measure them. We don't encourage and reward students to acquire them. We don't recognize schools for producing them. And so we have this kind of very narrow notion of success in our country. And I think if we had a broader notion of emotional and social learning, achievement, and some people have talked about multiple intelligences. You know, there's an array of research that's kind of talked about these different dimensions. But if we thought about schooling that way, and again, both encouraged and rewarded students, schools, even the state system for developing these kinds of skills and attributes, I think more kids would experience success. You know, I think the fundamental, I wouldn't say the fundamental cause, but one of the main causes of dropping out is a sense of failure. So, and the failure may be in high school that, you know, we talked about the idea of not earning credits. But as Mike suggested, failure, actually, you can see it before high school. So we've done studies in middle school. Middle school failure predicts high school failure. High school failure predicts dropping out. Even failure in elementary school, you know, doing poorly, failing
that way.
Actually,
as I said in the last hour, third grade reading tests have almost a predictive power.
They do have. They do have. And third grade attendance as well. So I think what you'd see in a lot of dropouts is a profile of failure after failure after failure. If we had a broader definition of success, and not just in high school, but I focus more on high school, that kids could experience success, then that success would enable them to be more successful in other things. But again, we only define success more narrowly. So if we define success broadly to include these other kinds of skills and attributes, that will serve people well. You know, there was a study done of people that were born in the Depression to see what predicted their success in later adult life in their 60s and 70s as measured by, did they have a stable job, did they have stable relationships, were they out of poverty? And they could find that the prediction of adult success was predicated on what happened to them in high school. So high school is a very influential time in people's lives. And what the study found is that students that developed a sense of what they called planful competence, if they could become competent, they were more successful as adults. It didn't say competence in physics. It didn't say competence in math. It just said competence. So if we could develop and encourage kids to develop a sense of competence in something, so whether it was physics, math, auto mechanics, culinary arts, media, whatever it may be, and they develop that sense of competence, then I would, not only I think it would help them graduate, but I think it would help them be successful adults.
And Russell Rumberger, again, is the author of Dropping Out and is Vice Provost for Education Partnerships with the UC Office of the President and directs the California Dropout Research Project. We're going to go to our audience here, and Dana, have somebody here who's going to speak to us. Yes, hi.
Yeah, hi. My name is Tessa Nicholas. I'm head of school at CivicCorps Corps Member Academy here in Oakland. And I just really appreciate this conversation happening. Our school serves 18 to 24-year-olds who have been former dropouts and are coming to our school to reengage with their high school diploma, and also allows them an opportunity to have paid job training. And I think that's just one of the components that draws them to our program, because we are recognizing that as a young adult, We need to serve the whole person. And, you know, many of our students are young parents, former foster care, adjudicated youth. And so that the full service community school model is how we've been able to be successful in graduating our students and putting them on a path where they've built their resume, they've gained the job skills, and are able to either go on to accreditation programs, jobs, or post-secondary education. And it's been, you know, the direction that OUSD is taking and in OUSD supporting our school really, you know, means a lot to the community, and recognizing that we do need multiple paths for our students.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm wondering, Tony Smith, when kids say, well, I'll just get a GED, you know, why do I need a high school diploma? The sheepskin isn't necessarily going to be any better than getting a GED. What's the message from you to that?
Well, I think we have to create the conditions for kids to see a path for themselves, a path to success. If, in fact, the GED is part of a larger plan and they've had the support, then I could support that. But oftentimes, and you've seen the research, and it's not going to help them be successful in the long term. So I think the message is...
You got a kind of a sales marketing job, don't you, in a way?
Well, we have a bigger job than that, I would say. We have to really reengage whole sections of our community that have, for generations, been pushed out and not supported. And I think the larger connections that... Russ was making around social-emotional learning, the connectivity, community service. I mean, the part of what's powerful about CivicCorps, deep respect for individual students coming back, very high expectations, a very clear structure, and yet it's personalized and connected. I mean, we have to do that in our high schools, and we have to find ways to reengage even kids who are still in school. We have not created the conditions for them to be on a trajectory to high-quality academic content in a high-touch, project-based environment that they see is heading them in a direction of productive future. So, I mean, Oakland has to decide what we expect of our 18-year-olds. It's not about the failure of Oakland Unified School District and dropouts and pushouts. Oakland has to have a different sensibility around its young people. We still have a narrative of pathologizing our kids. And until that changes and the expectation that kids here are successful, powerful, incredible leaders, which they are, we're going to keep fighting this battle over and over again. So we've got a larger issue in front of us than just changing high school, which is a big deal. but we, I think kids have to understand that coming to school, they're going to be safe, well-known, they're going to be demanded much of and supported to be successful.
Again, Dr. Tony Smith is superintendent of the Oakland Joint Unified School District, and we'll go to your calls. Bianca is joining us from Piedmont. Welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for your conversation today. I just wanted to bring up the issue. I worked for Oakland Unified School District for 10 years, and I'm actually getting ready to relaunch my career with Oakland. And I worked at a small alternative high school in Oakland, and the real critical thing here is in building those personal relationships with our students and in developing a school culture that demands and supports excellence from our students. And to that end, some of the things that need to happen is that students need to be exposed. So we took our students on field trips to places like PeopleSoft. I had Dr. Tom Nazario from UCSF always placed his street law students into my classroom, and one of my students ended up working at PeopleSoft. So I took my students on a field trip to PeopleSoft, and it was an eye-opening experience for those young people. In addition, we took them to UC Berkeley, we took them to UCSF. So our kids need to understand that there's something out there for them beyond the block-by-block radius that they call home. In addition to that, you have to bring people into the schools. So to that end, I would have people, I'm a graduate of UC Berkeley, I had people from the La Raza Recruitment and Retention Center come into my school and work with my students. And those are young people of color who are on these college campuses from the Black and La Raza Recruitment Center, and they would come in and they would work on personal statements and helping my kids to see that there is a life beyond what it is that they know. And that is just those developing those personal relationships and giving students some hope that there's something beyond what it is that they know. And the simple exposure cannot be underestimated in terms of creating a system that is going to be supportive and supportive to the needs of those students and responsive to the needs of the kids on that campus. And
yeah,
the
you
last
said
point
it very
is like,
well, excuse me, I was just going to add, in fact, when you were talking about taking kids out, some of these programs that take kids out to experience nature have had remarkable kinds of success and have really literally opened up eyes and senses entirely. Yes. I'm sorry, you're going to add one other point. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the last point I wanted to add was that I think that the solution to this in the really larger sense is really political, because you really have to have we need to have an honest conversation in our country and take the conversation away from failing kids and failing schools and failing teachers and really look at resources and allocation of resources in our country. And that's really what that demands is that we band together and say that every child from every community deserves a healthy education and deserves to be fed and deserves to partake in what it is that our society has to offer, because the economic, social, and political disenfranchisement of large swaths of our society is not sustainable. Thank you very much. And
no,
thank
you.
Thank
you for those good comments. We were supposed to have No Child Left Behind. we're going to go to the audience. We don't want to leave the audience behind here either. Hi. Tell us your name.
Hi, good morning. My name is Teresa. I am a junior at East Oakland School of the Arts, and my question is, how can you tell us what the solution is when you're not at the school at our age, at a teenage age, going through our problems, just like a lot of the students face here at Castlemont? Like, what are the solutions, even though you aren't here with us every day?
That's a fair question. Who wants to step up to the plate on this one? The superintendent will, because...
Well, first, I appreciate the question. I think it's so important, youth voice in shaping where we're headed. I think we're really fortunate in Oakland. I mean, right next door with Youth Uprising, which is a wonderful space to gather and really has a youth development focus and is engaged with community and young people, youth together. I mean, we have structures both in and around the schools. Personally, my job is to spend time across the different school sites. I do sit with groups of young people and hear stories from students about what it's like to try to take the bus to school and have to get off and walk different blocks around, so I don't take the bus through a certain section, because if I do, the chance I'm going to make it to school okay goes way down. I mean, and how many adults in our community know and understand that young people are navigating the city by blocks and understanding where they're safe and where they're not just to get to school? So, I mean, a lot of the notion of the full-service community school and going just from the family center to the youth and family center came directly from youth feedback. So, personally, I try to listen. I am not at every school every day. And my role and responsibility is to try to create a sustainable system that will meet the needs of young people, taking their feedback, but also, honestly, giving young people feedback about what the standard of performance and expectation in the world of work and beyond. And that means giving some feedback to our educators about holding higher expectations, about being willing to cross some race and class lines, to give very direct feedback about how to communicate expectations, how to be in the world. We have a lot of work to do, not just to listen to young people, but to give feedback to our whole system about raising the standard and expectation. So, yeah, I'm not there every day, but I do my best to listen, and I appreciate the question very much.
And we thank you for the question. We've got another gentleman. We've got a lady over here, please.
Hi, my name is Ekta Shah. I'm from the Institute for Sustainable Economic, Educational, and Environmental Design. We're a nonprofit in Oakland, California, and we build college and career pathways with young people and communities. And my question is actually a lot along the lines of what Teresa just brought up, and that is the role of student voice and active engagement of student voices at the institutional level. And Edson also spoke to this in the last hour, where he feels that he can't necessarily speak out about all these articulate reasons that he has for not being engaged in school. So I'm wondering, even beyond just a maybe anecdotal level, like on a structural and institutional level, what is the role of engaging student voice actively at the district provost research?
Not only what's the role, but how do you get students to make their voices heard more? I mean, to a greater degree. I think that's implicit in the question, too, if I may. Michael Kirst or Russ Remberger, some thoughts?
Well, I think it is very important to have student voices, and it really gives you the texture and the background of the problem. I think the listeners who heard the first hour today and heard the student who was, you know, thinking about dropping out and why and all the forces that came together, it's very hard for educators, I think, to focus on some of this when there's so much emphasis on curriculum instruction, which is very important, and we haven't talked, I think, enough about instructional quality in this panel, because if students are going to experience success, they've got to have some academic success, and that's got to be very strong. But I think the student voices are important, and that's the theory of more personalized education, that they're more close to the students, they listen to them more. Our class sizes are getting huge. I think your high school classes here, some of them are 35. 35? There's not any research in the country about what happens when you go from 20 students, as we did in the elementary grades, to over 30, 35. So we have to organize student voices then, I think, in a different way than expecting it to just come up through the classroom.
Well, I just want to say that student voice alone is not sufficient if there's not action based on that voice. And that's where, and it does get down to resources, unfortunately, but one of the things we really haven't talked about that much is the role of having this individual in the typically in the school, who serves as an advocate and a counselor and a mentor for the individual students. That's just got to be part of the solution. And, you know, the example you gave of the young man that had this problem at home, if they'd had that kind of relationship with somebody, that would have been known before that happened. So we need to make that kind of have that adult connection in these schools so that students may voice collectively to kind of the issues that may be going on in your school or your community, but each individual student who has a voice about his or own problems need to have somebody that can respond to them. And so the voice alone to me is not sufficient if there's not action based on that voice.
And since Mike Hurst mentioned teachers, I think it's also important to point out, Tony Smith, you can just verify this, with the $40 million deficit gone now, there aren't going to be as many pink slips, at least for the immediate future, for teachers.
Yeah, two things real quick. So just on the structural piece about student voice, so we have in Oakland meaningful student engagement, which is it's both staffed. Raquel Jimenez is a wonderful leader in that area in our organization. And the youth leadership in Oakland actually have worked on and brought policy and done youth organizing. The requirement for A to G, California State University System and UC, A to G is now expected for everybody, and that was really youth-led, and that resulted in policy. And also the restorative justice policy, our youth leaders really led that with Fania. So young people with structural support in the district, but really taking the lead from young people. And then we have been really fortunate. Last year, we sent 550 statutory layoff notices. We then actually followed through on 96 of those that we had to, for budgetary reasons, reduce the teaching force. Because we've eliminated the structural deficit, this year we sent zero statutory layoff notices.
Also, here. We're going to go to the audience in just a second, but Fania Davis, I want to just get you on record here. Obviously, if students have more of a voice, there's more of those kinds of dots connecting you were talking about before in terms of the whole community.
Absolutely. And restorative justice really, at its core, promotes that kind of agency. And that kind of self-determination and that voice from students, because the students have a say. If they have committed harm, if they've hurt somebody, nobody's going to do something to them, which is the punitive way. If they sit in a circle, they will talk with the person they harmed and maybe supporters and other people who are impacted. And everyone together, including that young person, will make the decision about what he is to do in order to repair that harm. What is this a plan? So there's buy-in, and there's a great story. This, I think, was a middle school, not a high school, where there was bullying. It was rife. They threw a lot of money at it. They had expensive consultants come in. They had all kinds of beautiful posters and brochures. Did it change any bullying? No, it stayed the same. So a restorative justice circle keeper came in and did a simple thing. Had a circle with about 15 youth and did some trust building exercises. We do things that really allow us to experience a deeper connection on a human to human and heart to heart level. That's part of what we do in restorative justice. So he started the circle that way and then asked the students, well, you know, how do you feel about this bullying. And they talked about it. And, what can we do about it? They came up with suggestions. And these suggestions were followed. They were acted upon, and the bullying problem ended. So doing with students as opposed to doing to them, you're going to get much better results.
We go back to our audience.
The winner in this presentation is not only the students, but the student environment. So I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you for that.
Now, if you come back, I think you should lead off by doing an historical perspective of Castlemont High School. In its heyday, Castlemont had more than 3,000 youngsters in a given school year. Not only that, but it has produced Hall of Fame athletes. So I think that'd be very valuable to give us some historical background to let us know how we got to this point. It's important to recognize who's here, that you're here. That's important. California Endowment is here. It was briefly referenced that Bill Gates and his $2 million contribution. It's not exactly a drop in the bucket. That should be recognized. Where is Silicon Valley? Right in this Bay Area, we have such a wealth of resources. The university, Stanford University, University of California, all the other institutions of higher learning. It's an opportunity for us to get those resources back here in East Oakland at Castlemont. Where is Bank of America, Wells Fargo, General Motors that were here at one time? The community has suffered by the absence of all these economic resources.
You know, excuse me, we're coming to the end of the, and I'm glad we're actually ending on that note. Where is, where are the greater resources going to come? And I take that as a challenge, and I thank you for it. And I want to thank all of you students and members of the community who are here with us, and thank our special guest this hour, Michael Kurse, president of the California State Board of Education and professor emeritus of education at Stanford, Russell Rumberger, who is vice provost for education partnerships at UC Office of the President and director of the California Dropout Research Project, author of the book Dropping Out, Fania Davis, executive director of the Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, and Superintendent Tony Smith, superintendent of Oakland Joint Unified School District. Thank you all. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Polly Stryker, and Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineers today are Danny Bringer, Jane Heaven, and Howard Gelman. Our interns are Keith Manconi, Ernesto Garcia Morales, Dana Varinsky, and Catalina Viejas. And again, special thanks to our intern Kyle Palmer on his last day. Special thanks to Aaron Bauman, Troy Flint, and the Oakland Unified School District for allowing us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg. Additional funding for this Forum special is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.